The eyes of the political world turn to the Peachtree State. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, the latest on the ground up in Georgia as the state certifies its election results and looks ahead to two very important U.S. Senate runoffs. What are your questions about what's happening in Georgia? Are you up there in South Georgia listening right now? Give us a call. St. Mary's, Glynn County, and all of you up there in that region. It's 549-2937. Then later, could a saliva test be effective in detecting COVID-19? We'll tell you about a local study looking at just that. But first this hour, here is the latest on the pandemic. Florida's number of hospitalizations due to COVID-19 kept rising Tuesday. There are now 3,369 patients in hospitals across the state with a primary diagnosis of COVID. That is a big jump from this time last month. The death toll around the state rose by 86 people overnight as well. We say this every morning and we'll say it again right now. The coronavirus continues to spread basically uncontrolled all over the nation and in Florida. Positive cases and hospitalizations are on the rise. So please continue to mask, socially distance, and avoid large groups. All right, let's get to the other big story of the morning. Georgia is on schedule to finish its audit of the presidential election later today and certify results there by Friday. That according to election officials in the Peachtree State. They say no major discrepancies have been found in a hand count of ballots there after President-elect Joe Biden narrowly won the state and flipped it from red to blue. Now, Georgia is required by law to certify by Friday. That would thwart a long-shot effort by President Trump to delay certification and potentially try to overturn the results of the state's ballots through the Electoral College. The president has repeatedly made unfounded allegations of fraud following his election defeat on November 3rd. His campaign has launched legal challenges in multiple states trying to prevent the certification of results. Now, at the same time, a couple of closely watched runoff elections for the U.S. Senate will happen in the new year in Georgia, and the result of those runoffs will determine whether President-elect Biden has the ability to enact an ambitious agenda for the country or whether the Senate will block him. So Georgia is at the center of things today. Tia Mitchell is Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she's on the line right now. Hi, Tia.
Hey, how you doing?
It's so good to hear your voice. And of course, people in Jacksonville well remember you from your time working for the Florida Times Union. So it's good to have you on the show. What are your questions, everyone, about Georgia, the vote recount there and the Senate runoffs? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open too. So Tia, what's the latest on Georgia's audit of the election results?
Well, as you mentioned, the audit is the counties face a deadline of basically midnight tonight, Wednesday, and most of the larger counties are done. And so even though I was doubtful that all 159 Georgia counties could meet that deadline, they had about like 5 days to get it done. They got it done, it looks like. So it looks like the recount will be wrapping up tonight. However, the state has made it clear that the recount will not replace the official, well, unofficial voting results that were tabulated based on the machines in the regular election day process.
So the recount won't change the results. Is the recount expected to move the numbers a little bit one way or the other towards President Trump or President-elect Biden?
Yes, so far. So, and it's interesting, the recount has found some votes that were not counted properly, that has changed the margin. But those are votes that will be counted as a part of the official tally because they were votes that were not counted. So that has changed the margin by, it went from about 14,000 that Joe Biden was ahead to now about 13,000. However, the recount itself, which is smaller margins, a vote here, a vote there, those differences will not be tabulated. So again, there are some new differences in the official vote count. Again, because Georgia's system, for those of you who, like me, used to vote in Jacksonville and you're used to marking a paper ballot and the ballot says what it says, it's a lot more complicated in Georgia. They have like touch screens and computers and memory cards. And so there are a lot more touch points for error in Georgia.
Give us a call, Georgia and Florida. It's 549-2937. Okay, so Tia, the Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger is his name. He's also a lifelong Republican. He says he's getting extraordinary political pressure to somehow overturn the results in Georgia, including from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Graham is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington. What is Raffensperger alleging is happening?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, Raffensperger, initially it was, you know, Trump, President Trump and his allies, including Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler, who are both in these runoffs that I know we'll talk about a little bit later. But they were, without really any evidence, accusing Secretary Raffensperger of, you know, botching the election, not doing a good job managing election, allowing illegal votes, but they had very little evidence. And initially, Secretary Raffensperger, who is Secretary of State, he is elected. Again, we know that Florida changed that after the 2000 recount. Georgia's Secretary of State is still elected. And so he pushed back and would say, you know, we're doing a good job. But then he did this blockbuster interview where he said not only did he push back on fellow Republicans who were questioning the integrity of the election, but he said, actually, I have Republicans asking me to not count all the votes. And he accused Senator Graham of South Carolina of calling him up and asking him about mail-in ballot and how they match signatures and if there's a way to not count them in certain counties. And that kind of created a turn where Raffensperger was going on the offensive against some of his fellow Republicans. So there's a lot of GOP infighting right now.
It's even being called a Republican civil war in Georgia over how this is all going to shake out. Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, so far he's really standing up to pressure within his own party to actually toss legally cast mail ballots. This is really an extraordinary situation. Georgia was won narrowly by Joe Biden by just, what is it, about 12,000 votes or so. And it has long been a red state. It flipped blue due to a lot of grassroots efforts on the ground led by Stacey Abrams of the group Fair Fight and some others. Heavy turnout in Atlanta, but also in Savannah, and slightly bluer cast of counties in spots around Georgia, including a slightly bluer tilt in the counties in our listening area in South Georgia. So, Tia, is it accurate to say that this is a Republican civil war in Georgia over political power in the state?
I think it's a Trump-led Republican offense, and because Republicans control Georgia's government, all three branches of the, you know, they control the House, the Senate, all statewide offices. So it's a Trump offensive, but right now, because it happens that Georgia is controlled by Republicans, they are going on the offense against fellow Republicans. But I don't think it's the party. I think it's President Trump and those who are so loyal to him. They will burn any and everything down at any cost, including fellow Republicans. The question is, what happens after this current moment is over? You know, and that question also is about where does President Trump go when all of this is over? If he remains, as many of us suspect, a very visible and prominent voice in the Republican Party, then there will always be these divisions because there are Republicans who will do whatever President Trump asked of them because they believe his support and his base is that important to their political futures. And that, in a state like Georgia, will put them at odds of other Republicans who aren't willing to go that far, who say, you know, undermining the integrity of an election process led by Republicans, that's a step too far, and we're going to stand up to that. But there are not, that is not a universal position for some of Georgia's most prominent Republicans.
Let's go to your calls now as we speak with Tia Mitchell. She's Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. What are your questions about the election results in Georgia? It's 549-2937. Paul is on the south side here on the Florida side of the line. Hey, Paul, good morning.
Good morning. You know, regardless of the outcome of Georgia, the election and the Electoral College will have gone to Biden. And I think the major issue is if Lindsey Graham, in fact, encouraged the Secretary of State in Georgia to discard valid ballots, that's the problem that we should be focusing on.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, Tia, Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, according to Georgia's Secretary of State, Graham called him, pressured him to throw out ballots. Graham denies doing that, although he did admit to calling Brad Raffensperger. There were apparently witnesses to this call. Graham also claimed he called secretaries of state around the country where ballots are still being audited, like Nevada and Arizona. Those secretaries of state say, no, he did not call us. Will Lindsey Graham face any consequences for what appears to be an attempt to tamper with the election result?
I expect there will be ethics complaints filed against Senator Graham. I would suspect that those complaints will probably wait till everything is said and done to avoid not becoming a distraction that can be used against Democrats during this crucial runoff. But quite frankly, ethics complaints are filed against lawmakers in Washington for far less. So I don't see a scenario where there won't be ethics complaints and investigations. And those will take time to shake out. But I'm sure he can expect those things to happen. Whether he'll ultimately be cited is something that I don't think anyone can predict. But I think he should expect the investigation.
It's 549-2937, whether you're in Florida or Georgia. We want to hear from you. Okay, let's talk about the Georgia runoffs. They will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Two important runoffs in January in Georgia. Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler face challenges from Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. The Democrats need to flip both of these seats to have unified control of the White House and Congress. So much money, Tia, is pouring into Georgia already to affect the outcome. How do you see these runoffs playing out? I mean, there was extraordinary turnout in Georgia, as we saw everywhere, but it's going to be hard for either side to motivate their base, I would think, to come out and vote yet again in this runoff that is coming.
Yes, so there are a lot of variables here. Let's talk about the Republican side. You know, you have the leader of your party, President Trump, undermining the integrity of the election, undermining the integrity of mail-in balloting. And there is concern that, again, this runoff requires people to kind of get motivated to do it all over again. And so will Republican turnout be depressed because of all the questions about whether your vote even matters in Georgia? Whereas on the Democratic side, you have a similar issue as far as turnout being a big concern, but that's because Democrats just historically have not performed well in statewide runoffs. You know, Democratic voters, Democrats always have had a harder time turning out their less involved, newer voters, less active voters, less engaged voters. That's always been a bigger hurdle for Democrats, and now they've got to do it in a runoff that doesn't have as much visibility as, you know, a presidential election year. Now, what's going to negate that on both sides, as you mentioned, is all the money, all the attention on Georgia. And, you know, we're just getting started. This is a, it was an 8-week runoff period. We're now, you know, a couple of weeks in, but as we get closer to that January 5th final day of the election, as we get into the early voting period, as we get into the period where absentee ballots start being mailed to voters, it's going to ratchet up, and it's going to be unavoidable for Georgia voters. The question is, how many of which side can turn out more voters and raise the stakes, knowing that the balance of power at the U.S. Senate is what's at stake.
Sure. And a lot of attention was paid to the extraordinary turnout in Atlanta. But can you talk a little bit about the other parts of the state and how they played a role in the outcome in Georgia? Because let's take a moment to reflect once again how extraordinary it is that a Democrat won Georgia in the presidential election. That's a really earth-shaking political development in your state. We're having trouble hearing you, Tia. We're having trouble hearing you.
Let me move around.
There you go. That's better.
Just a little better?
Yeah.
Okay. So the last time a Democratic presidential candidate won in Georgia was Bill Clinton in 1992. He did not carry the state in 1996. And during that period, Republicans, again, were gaining more control, more power in Georgia government. As to right now, again, Republicans control the legislature, control the governor's office, and all statewide elected offices. And so it is very extraordinary that this is the year that a Democrat was able to win in a presidential race. But we know that there are so many factors at play. You asked about turnout. So in Georgia, of course, statewide, Georgia became bluer. But in Atlanta suburbs became bluer. And then in Savannah, in some of the surrounding counties in Savannah became much bluer. And that has really helped. College-educated white people really soured on President Trump. You know, older voters soured on President Trump partially because of the coronavirus pandemic. And then the other thing at play is Georgia is becoming a more diverse state. As the state grows, new people are moving in. There are more people of color. There are younger people, and those people tend to vote Democratic more often. And so all these demographic shifts, as well as, again, not necessarily demographic shifts, but just college-educated white voters voting for Biden in bigger numbers, contributed to his win in the state.
Hmm. We're speaking with Tia Mitchell of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She's their Washington correspondent, bringing us up to date on everything happening in Georgia as the state is expected to finish its audit of the presidential election today, certify its results by Friday. It's expected the electoral votes for Georgia will go to President-elect Joe Biden. Despite what the Secretary of State in Georgia says has been extraordinary pressure on him to somehow overturn the results. Give us a call, 549-2937, Tom, Thomas in St. Mary's, Georgia. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring to your attention, I hopefully you have it in front of you, Camden County has posted their recount numbers. I think as you can see in front of you, the difference in the official count after the election and the recount is very, very small. Less than 10. Do you see those numbers?
I see the email you just sent me. It looks like Donald Trump gained one vote in St. Mary's, Camden County, and Joe Biden gained two, it looks like. Is that right?
No, the Trump gained, it went from...
It's more like 12 votes. Yeah, I'm just glancing at it. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, and Biden gained two, and Jorgensen, there was a exact match. The other things I want to bring to your attention and the audience attention, not only are the Senate races in Georgia important, we have a public service commission a race that will be on the runoff, and municipal elections, we have two seats in St. Mary's for county for city council that are up for election. Also, the early voting dates are going to be really, really difficult this time because of the holidays, Thanksgiving falling in the middle of the recount period. So tomorrow our Board of Elections is having a meeting to decide the locations, times, and dates for the early voting. And lastly, I want to bring everybody's attention to the absentee ballot, which was such a large turnout in Camden County as well as Georgia. Absentee ballot requests should be submitted by those people that want to go that route, even if they voted in the regular election. If they're under 65 or don't qualify for automatic reissue of the absentee ballot, they need to request it again. So that information is available online and through the newspaper, which is our Tribune in Georgian. But those are highlights that mm-hmm. we need to make sure absentee ballot votes are as strong during the runoff as they were during the general election.
Thank you so much for all of that, Tom. That's Tom up in St. Mary's, Georgia. Tia, Tom is following this closely in his county, of course. And as he pointed out, the recount only netted the president a handful of new votes in his county and a couple of new votes for Joe Biden. And, you know, it's interesting, too, when he talked about absentee ballots and the upcoming runoff, people will still want to vote absentee in January in the Senate runoffs in Georgia. I was also struck by comments yesterday from the Georgia Secretary of State that because President Trump did so much to discredit mail-in voting, that he actually hurt himself in Georgia, that a lot of Republicans in Georgia voted in the primary by mail, but then did not do it in the general election. The Secretary of State there, Mr. Raffensperger, thinks Donald Trump could have won Georgia if he had not tried to discredit mail-in voting.
Yeah, he said there were, I think, about 24,000 Republicans who just didn't vote at all in the general election. And again, like I mentioned before, Raffensperger is now going on the offensive. I think we need to take anything he says with a grain of salt because we have to, and I'm not saying he's not telling the truth, but, you know, he's giving his take on things, and we haven't. There are a lot of data about the election that is still going to need to be studied and analyzed, and we don't have the complete picture because the election itself is not finalized. But I take him at his word for it that there were 24,000 Republicans who didn't vote. And again, if we think that most of those Republicans would have voted for Donald Trump, then yes, we know 24,000 would have put him over the edge.
Well, given that we're all weary of the pandemic, we're all ready to move on from the election, what else do you expect to come out of this? On Friday, Georgia will almost certainly certify its results. But, you know, there are still efforts around the country to delay certification of electors and somehow keep President Trump in the White House despite the clear results that we've seen. Last night in Wayne County, Michigan, the county that encompasses Detroit, there was this dust up where a couple of members of the Wayne County Canvassing Board initially refused to certify the results. There's a lawsuit in Nevada seeking to overturn the results there and call for another whole new slate of electors that would certify Nevada for the president, even though we lost the state. These trends are alarming.
Yes, but I think, again, to keep it with a grain of salt, yes, there was a dust up in Wayne County, but they came back and they certified the results later that same day. So far, there have been temporary roadblocks, and we have to stay vigilant.
We're having trouble hearing you again, Tia. Sorry.
I'm sorry. There have been temporary roadblocks. But so far, I think voters have to stay vigilant and engaged in the process and ensure that the elected officials are following the law. You know, our democracy cannot work if we make decisions based on partisanship. We have to make decisions based on what is the law, what are the facts. So in a state like Georgia, even though we have Republicans in charge, if they follow the law, Joe Biden has won in Georgia. There has now been a statewide recount by hand, there, and Joe Biden has still won in Georgia. And so, so far, most states have indicated they are willing to, well, all states so far have indicated they are willing to follow the law. They are hearing President Trump out when there are legal challenges. Those challenges just haven't gone anywhere. They've fallen apart very quickly, as a matter of fact. So we do think that Georgia will certify the election on Friday. Again, we have Secretary Raffensperger, who has indicated that so far, even the members of the General Assembly, which are Republicans that lead the General Assembly in Georgia, even those who have said, you know, President Trump should be able to make whatever challenges he wants to make, have not said that they don't believe the results should be certified. So we're hoping that, again, everything continues to go relatively smoothly.
As the process grinds on, I do want to make note of the fact that a new Reuters Ipsos opinion poll finds today that about half of all Republicans believe President Trump rightfully won the U.S. election, but that it was stolen from him by widespread voter fraud that favored President-elect Biden. This is simply not true. It's just not
right.
True.
It's not true, and it's based on misinformation. Misinformation that is coming not only from President Trump, but from his allies like Senator Loeffler and Senator Perdue in Georgia. And it's also coming from far-right media companies that have a financial stake in sowing misinformation and kind of keeping their listeners and readers indoctrinated to the Trump way that isn't always based in truth. And it's interesting because now we're seeing that split where Fox News, even though we've known Fox News to support President Trump, they decided there was a line that this media organization would not cross, and now Fox News is on the out. And there are other media organizations that are willing to cross that line and go even further to back up the misinformation being peddled by President Trump. And so that's, again, another reminder to your listeners and all those who deal in truth and facts. You have to watch your sources, consider your sources, and value those sources that deal in truth and facts. Because too many Republican voters have been indoctrinated with propaganda that is not rooted in fact.
So good to have you on the show. She's Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead, meanwhile. Later in the hour, we'll tell you how Beaches Go Green is decking the chairs out at the beaches this holiday season with an environmental message. That's later in the hour, but up next.
And they're looking to see whether the saliva test is going to be as accurate as the traditional nasal PCR COVID test.
Could a saliva test actually be accurate in diagnosing COVID-19? A local study aims to find out. We'll be right back.
Join WJCT for Voices of the First Coast, One Small Step Across the Political Divide, a nationwide project with the goal of breaking down boundaries between strangers. At this free event, you'll hear from StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, listen to excerpts from select conversations recorded across the First Coast, and engage in discussion with participants. Join us on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. This virtual event is free, but reservations are required. Information at wjct.org/events.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, the local company Telescope Health is getting into some intriguing new FDA research around COVID testing. They're taking part in a research study, and it's going to look at whether saliva testing offers an accurate diagnosis for the coronavirus. Just a little spit sample instead of having that swab stuck up your nose. So saliva testing is being talked about as an affordable and easy alternative to those invasive nasal swab COVID test. But here's the issue. Would a saliva test be accurate? Dr. Matthew Rill is the CEO of Telescope Health here in Jacksonville. I spoke with him. Dr. Matthew Rill, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. I really enjoy your show. Thanks for having us on today.
Oh, happy to do it. You know, there are so many ongoing questions about COVID-19 testing and rapid testing versus traditional testing. People want to know if their results are accurate. You are participating in this study to look at saliva testing for COVID. Tell us about it. How is this working?
Yeah, so we're participating in an FDA study with a company called Protean Diagnostics out of Orlando. And they're looking to see whether the saliva test is going to be as accurate as the traditional nasal PCR COVID test. They're using a really interesting technology called next-generation sequencing, and it's similar in accuracy to PCR, but it gives them a lot more information about the virus itself, its DNA, and we think that information is very important for understanding what's happening with COVID-19 now and its mutations, but also developing vaccines down the road.
How can we know if saliva testing is an accurate way to determine if we have the disease, have an active virus?
So in this study, they're actually going to compare the saliva test directly to the current nasal PCR test. So it'll be a head-to-head comparison, and our hope is that the saliva is as accurate as PCR or better. And in that case, it really, you know, I think it offers patients a much more comfortable way to be tested. It's also safer for those that are administering the test. They wouldn't have to go through as much supplies or be as exposed to folks.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if this works, because certainly people that have to get the COVID test with the nasal swab have not exactly enjoyed that experience.
Right.
I mean, it's uncomfortable to say the least, isn't it?
It is. I can say that from firsthand knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And how often have you been tested?
You know, our team, we've been trying to be very careful with our team. So I personally have been tested 4 times, but we test our team members that are at the sites even more frequently to make sure that, one, they don't contract the illness, and two, they wouldn't be exposing any others to the illness.
So are you having people act as guinea pigs locally, offering up their saliva? How is this study working?
So Protean Diagnostics set it up so that if you have symptoms or you have a known exposure to somebody who's positive for coronavirus, they'll have you come into our site, and it's in Neptune Beach from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., Thursday through Saturday. And if you come in, they'll actually give you a $25 gift card for opting in. And when you're there, we'll collect our normal sample, which is a nasal sample at this point. But then Protean Diagnostics has us collect 3 more samples, 2 saliva, which is basically just spitting into a little test tube, and then 1 nasal for their comparison.
And how much longer is the research study going to be going on, and when might you have results?
You know, they've proven this NGS and next-generation sequencing to be effective in other body fluids, including the nasal and bronchial lavage. They're really trying to get EUA approval for the saliva test, and I would expect that we would know within, you know, late winter, early spring, whether or not this was effective.
And that's about the time we might be also having access to a vaccine. So early next year could be momentous for moving ahead on this virus, couldn't it?
We all hope so. I mean, there's a lot of great news right now about the different companies with, you know, progress in their vaccines, and we're hopeful that we see those land in Jacksonville here in the late winter, early spring.
Okay, but in the meantime, as we talk with Dr. Matthew Rill, CEO of Telescope Health, about their diagnostic research study, this has to do with whether saliva testing offers an accurate COVID-19 diagnosis. So as you mentioned, Doctor, could you repeat again how people can be part of this study?
Sure. If you'd like to participate, come to our Neptune Beach testing site. It's open from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. from Thursday through Saturday. And just opt in when they check you in, and they'll collect the needed samples while you're there. It just takes a few minutes. And then for your trouble, Protean Diagnostics is going to give you a $25 gift card.
Okay, so there's a little incentive. Any other thoughts about how this region is dealing with the ongoing pandemic? Because certainly we're all really weary of it, but we can't really let our guard down. The virus is still active.
No, I think you're right. And certainly if you look at other parts of the country, the numbers are just blossoming, and they've gone up in a lot of scary ways. I think, like what happened in the spring, we're lucky in the sense that we live in a fairly spread out environment. There's a lot of open air. It's not cold enough to drive people indoors. And I think that, the mayor's done a good job of promoting masks in our area, more so than some of the surrounding areas. And so our numbers are increasing, but they're not increasing at the rate we're seeing in other communities. So I think if people are careful during the holidays and socially distance and continue to wear masks and watch for surface contamination, we can just do common sense things to reduce the spread of the virus.
Absolutely right. Well, thank you so much. He's Dr. Matthew Rill, CEO of Telescope Health. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, time now for a little pop of positive in your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, where we highlight people and organizations doing good things in this challenging time, this challenging year of 2020. We've got a lot on our menu right now, so let's get into it. Beginning with the newly named Cathedral District in downtown Jacksonville. They have been flexing like crazy the last couple of years. Now, the Cathedral District celebrates the gorgeous and historic cathedrals clustered together in the city's urban core. And they are lighting them up once again this season with Christmas in the Cathedral District, Let There Be Light. Now, last year's celebration featured cathedral tours, a holiday market, live music. But because of the pandemic, this time around, what they're asking us to do is take part in a drive-through event that will showcase five historic downtown churches. This is happening every evening throughout the holiday season. The Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, First Presbyterian Church of Jax, First United Methodist Church, Historic Mount Zion AME Church, and St. John's Episcopal Cathedral will all be lit up like a disco ball. It's part of a driving tour you can do any night you want, and it includes more than 100 lit-up trees and other landmark buildings as well. This nightly light show, we're told, will be visible from all downtown bridges and I-95. Heck, you might even be able to see it from space, for all we know. There's even a green team using LED lighting, with help from JEA, to make this whole effort energy efficient. We see you, Cathedral District. We'll be having a guest on the show next week to tell us more about Let There Be Light. Going to be beautiful. Well, a beloved local tradition continues this year. It's Empty Bowls, sponsored by Feeding Northeast Florida. This is digital, virtual. So just go to jacksemptybowls.com and support Empty Bowls, because what they do is work to raise awareness of food insecurity on the First Coast and beyond. This runs through Giving Tuesday. You can buy locally made ceramic bowls to support the effort and support Feeding Northeast Florida. Again, jacksemptybowls.com. And how about this? After you pick up a bowl, you can also pick up a tree. And the trees are free. That's right. Greenscape of Jacksonville is holding its much-loved annual tree giveaway this weekend at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. This year, you can also bring documents to shred. Now, this is a drive-through event, too, and be advised, it is definitely first come, first served to pick up a gorgeous 3-gallon container tree. I spoke about it with Anna Dooley, Executive Director of Greenscape of Jacksonville.
This is a drive-through event. No one gets out of their cars. As people pull in, they will receive a menu, a tree menu, and they can see all of the different species that we're offering, and then they'll be able to take them home. We have 9 different species this year, beautiful crepe myrtles. We'll have live oaks, magnolias, red maples, and fringe trees, hollies, bald cypress, and special special purchase of Redbud.
Some great choices. Greenscape works to maintain and increase this city's lush tree canopy with events like their annual tree giveaway. Get out there Saturday morning, 9 a.m. at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. Add a beautiful tree to your yard. Again, this is free. And if you need paper documents to shred, bring those as well. They will do that for you. Well, St. Augustine's annual Knights of Light celebration continues this year, even in the pandemic. And we are also pleased to inform you that the fourth annual Knights of Pints is also going ahead in the nation's oldest city. Four St. Augustine breweries are taking part in the fun: Old Coast Ales, Bog Brewing Company, Dog Rose Brewing, and Ancient City Brewing. What you do is you buy a special commemorative t-shirt at any one of these breweries, and then you get a punch card, and it's good for one free pint at any of the listed watering holes through January 31st. You can check it out at facebook.com/knightsofpints. So when you check out the lights, you can also pick up a pint. Speaking of delicious and locally made craft brews, make sure to listen to tomorrow's show as we celebrate 10 years of Tasty Suds in the Jacksonville Urban Core, along with powerful local economic development. Yes, Intuition Ale Works is celebrating its 10th anniversary in downtown Jacksonville this month. They have been pouring it out throughout this challenging pandemic. It's actually been documented that locally owned microbreweries are a powerful tool for city vibrancy and economic development. So we celebrate their 10th anniversary. We raise a glass to Intuition Ale Works and all of the other locally owned places like them that bring in revenue and fun to cities. Now, if you've got some good news you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, we want to hear it. Just email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and subscribe to What's Good Wednesday. It's our free weekly e-newsletter highlighting the positive in this pandemic and recession. If you want to subscribe, that's also on our website. In a moment, we'll tell you how the beaches are going green this holiday season as we speak to the founder of Beaches Go Green and what she's doing to green up Deck the Chairs. That's in just a few moments. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
An Israeli winery has bottled up a vintage called Pompeo, and the U.S. Secretary of State may be dropping by for a taste. Problem is, the wine is made in a Jewish settlement built on what used to be Palestinian land. West Bank settlements are illegal under international law. Israelis and Palestinians watch as Mike Pompeo considers a bold move as brash as his namesake Cabernet. It's on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Tanya Mosley. As eviction moratoriums expire, renters and homeowners are facing new economic challenges. Former Obama HUD official Diane Yentl joins us to talk about the housing crisis, her hopes for the Biden administration, and whether she might be a part of it. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
the next Fresh Air, John Wiener, author of a book about the Chicago 7 conspiracy trial that's been reprinted to coincide with the new Aaron Sorkin film about the trial. Wiener says, at the end of the 60s, it seemed that all the conflicts in America were distilled and then acted out in the courtroom of the trial. He's written extensively about the 60s. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Moody, sometimes melancholy, Matt Berninger's latest album has been called gorgeous and unfussy, with a nod to the genius that gave us Green Eggs and Ham.
Missing, fishing, vision, prison. Big fan of Dr. Seuss.
I'm Jen White. The frontman for The National talks about his career and why he got involved in the Biden campaign. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. A large single-use plastic installation will be part of Deck the Chairs at the Beaches this season. Anne-Marie Moquin is the founder of Beaches Go Green. I spoke with her. Anne-Marie, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to talk about Beaches Go Green because you're very busy right now, beginning with a big exhibit you're going to be doing at Deck the Chairs, which is a beloved holiday tradition in Jacksonville Beach. Now, this sounds interesting. You're doing a plastic art installation, single-use plastic art installation. Is that right?
Yes. This will be our third year at Deck the Chairs. Our Beaches Go Green single-use plastic art installation, we call it the Octopus Garden, is a massive installation. We have two of our jellyfish coming back also from previous years. And we have an octopus with four tentacles showing, and the arms are covered in 15,318 single-use plastic bottles. And the fabric on the head of the octopus is called Reprieve, and it's made 90% of single-use plastic bottles. So we're really trying to make something beautiful out of something that's not so beautiful.
Yeah. And also educate the public about using less of single-use plastic products too, right?
Absolutely. A big part of our display is education. That's the whole mission and goal of Beaches Go Green, to create awareness around all of the waste that we produce and how it's impacting the planet. And I think when people see how the single-use plastic that we use in our convenience-based lifestyle really adds up, and it can take hundreds of years to break up into microplastics, it really makes you stop and think about your habits.
Yeah. We all can do a much better job with this. And so education is important. You have really made inroads into local schools, both elementary and high schools. What are you doing with students to raise awareness about single-use plastics?
So we currently have three school clubs. We have two at the high school level. One is at Pontevedra High School and the other is Nice High School. And then we just launched one at Fletcher Middle School. And the whole goal of the high school and middle school clubs is to teach the kids the fundamentals of plastic pollution and how our waste impacts the planet, and then get them to teach younger students. So due to COVID, we aren't able to go into other schools. So this year we launched a really exciting program. They're youth education mini videos, and most of the content is created by our high schoolers and other volunteers. They're fun, they're quick videos, they're educational, and I hope that it'll keep being environmentally friendly on the forefront of students and other people's mind rather than it just being for Earth Day.
This is so important because people under the age of 20 are going to bear the brunt of the impacts of the poor decisions people our age have made when it comes to the environment. So what kind of reactions are you getting from the students about all of this?
They're really surprised when they hear the statistics, and especially when you start talking about things like fast fashion, which wastes a lot of the Earth's resources. When you start talking about hidden plastics, that plastic is in chewing gum, or it's in tea bags, or it's in glitter, or wrapping paper, people, and even myself, before I started really researching it, I just didn't know. We just don't know. And so if I can get it on people's radar, then they'll be more educated to make better choices. And that's the same for the students. They're really optimistic that they can make a difference.
Yeah, and that's great. And so we can all make a difference by supporting Beaches Go Green. What else can people do to get involved?
Well, we have another program I wanted to talk to you about, which is really exciting, and it also impacts the youth. We launched a reusable water bottles for sports programs, and so far we have sponsored, along with community sponsors, almost 3,000 reusable water bottles for athletes in local schools. We have done Pontevedra High School, Fletcher Middle School. We're working on the YMCA Camp Immokalee, as well as all the Pontevedra Athletic Association sports like JDL, Storm Soccer, and so on. So we're really making an impact, focusing on choose reusable over single use. I don't know if you've ever been to any of the sports fields, but the garbage cans are typically overflowing in single-use plastic water bottles or Gatorade bottles. And so we've asked the team coaches and leaders to make the reusable bottles part of the uniform. And that's been really exciting. And quite honestly, the athletes and the students love sporting their logos on the bottles. And it's just a really proud thing. They've been using them in their everyday life as well as that practice in the game.
Fantastic. And a lot more at beachesgogreen.org. Check out the incredible sculpture they'll be doing at Deck the Chairs this year in Jack's Beach, a single-use plastic art installation, their Beaches Go Green Octopus Garden. It's going to be lighting up the night beginning Saturday, November 21st. And she is Anne Marie Moquin, founder at Beaches Go Green. Anne Marie, great work and thank you.
Thank you.
Check it out, everyone. That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Keep those emails coming to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast. We'll be up later today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day and wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.